Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're digging into a story that's really about living life as the understudy, not the main act. We're talking about Prince Harry's memoir from 2023, Spare.
Yeah, and this is, you know, it's such an important book to look at closely because, as our sources really emphasize, it goes way beyond just, like, royal gossip.
Right.
We're trying to figure out why this autobiography hits so hard. It's a case study, really, in grief that hasn't been dealt with, conflicts within huge institutions, and that search we all have for who we really are outside of the roles we're given.
Exactly. So our mission here is to pull out the book's core ideas, the psychology behind it. Forget the tabloid stuff for a minute. We want to understand why this story connected with so many people around the world. It's about trying to grab the reins of your own life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Even when it feels like your life path was already set in stone.
Yeah.
And that title, Spare, it just perfectly sums it all up, doesn't it? It is the thesis. What does it mean to be the backup, the contingency for a role you're fundamentally not supposed to fill?
Oh.
That feeling of being, well, almost unnecessary, defined by what you aren't. That seems to have shaped Harry from day one.
Okay, let's get into that. How he was formed by this. The sources say this dynamic started, like, immediately. The day he was born, his father, Prince Charles back then, apparently joked, "My work is done," because they had the heir and the spare.
Oof, that's just brutal, isn't it? To sort of launch someone into life feeling like they're inherently second best, maybe even expendable.
That is a huge psychological weight from the start.
Definitely. But the real, the foundational trauma, the thing that changed everything, was his mother, Princess Diana, dying in August 97. Harry was just 12. His whole world, already kind of strange and constrained, just completely shattered.
And the image that stays with you, the real emotional gut punch, is that public grieving. Mm-hmm. Having to walk behind her coffin with that little card just saying, "Mummy."
In front of the whole world.
Yeah, billions watching.
And being forced to perform grief rather than actually process it privately, well, it led to this massive emotional shutdown. He actually talks about going into suspended disbelief.
Right. I remember reading that.
It was coping mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah.
He literally convinced himself she hadn't really died, that she'd staged it and would come back eventually.
Wow. For years.
For years. His whole identity was shaped by her absence and by those paparazzi he saw as, you know, directly responsible for her death.
I think that's something anyone can connect with, really. Maybe not the scale, but the idea of unprocessed grief just eating away at you, yeah, trying to run from that pain.
Absolutely. It's a very human thing, just magnified by the whole royal fishbowl. And that internal pain, that ache, it totally fueled the party prince image we all saw.
Ah, right. The coping mechanism.
Exactly. The sources talk about alcohol, drugs, adrenaline,
mm-hmm,
anything to numb that trauma he wasn't facing.
Which brings us to some of the really low points he writes about, like the Nazi costume incident back in 2005. He calls it out as incredibly immature, terrible judgment.
Which he clearly was.
But importantly, he doesn't just leave it there. He talks about what he did after meeting the chief rabbi, visiting Auschwitz. It shows these, like, early, maybe clumsy, but real attempts to take responsibility.
It's a glimmer of accountability, yeah. But the real turning point, the big escape hatch, was the army.
10 years in the British army, he says it was the only time he felt normal.
Totally normal.
Mm.
He wasn't Prince Harry the Spare anymore. He was Captain Wales, valued for his skills, his rank, merit, not birth. That was huge for him.
That contrast is so important, isn't it? Meritocracy versus just inheriting your position. The army gave him a purpose. Royalty couldn't, it seems.
A very tangible purpose. 2 tours in Afghanistan. He found competence, a mission.
And he doesn't really sugarcoat that experience either, does he?
No, not at all. Which brings us to that controversial bit about killing 25 Taliban fighters. The analysis suggests he put that in not to brag, but as a soldier's, like clinical accounting.
Just stating a fact.
A fact he felt he had to state to process the combat, the PTSD. For him, saying it out loud was part of healing, which is, you know, completely different from the usual royal never complain, ever explain thing.
A radical break, yeah. And what grew out of that military experience became his big solo achievement, right? The Invictus Games.
Yes. Founded in 2014. His first major project that was all his, born directly from his time in service and his passion for helping wounded soldiers. Universally praised, too.
Okay, before we get to the major conflict, the institution versus Harry, we have to touch on that one really bizarre story that everyone talked about. The frostbitten Todger.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's almost darkly funny, but it works so well as a metaphor for his whole life in the firm, as they call it.
Remind us, he got severe frostbite after a trip to the North Pole.
And then had to stand there at William's wedding, the massive global event, smiling, doing his duty as best man.
While secretly applying his mother's Elizabeth Arden cream to his, well, his bits in total agony.
The symbolism is just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's the damaged one, literally, in hidden, excruciating, kind of humiliating pain, but he has to put on a perfect show for his brother, the heir.
His individual suffering had to be invisible for the sake of the royal show.
Exactly. Which leads us straight into that great conflict, the institution versus the individual. Harry lays out this core problem, this toxic symbiotic relationship, he calls it an invisible contract, between the monarchy and the tabloid press.
Okay, break that down. What's the contract, according to him?
He sees it as a transaction. Basically, the institution feeds the press certain stories, maybe leaks, gives them access, especially around dramas involving, say, the spare or other individuals.
Sort of throwing them a bone.
Right. And in exchange, the press holds back from scrutinizing the crown's actual power, its finances, the stuff the institution really doesn't want examined. The focus stays on the personal soap opera.
And his argument is that this whole system just throws individual family members under the bus, sacrifices their mental health, their privacy.
For the sake of institutional stability and good PR, that's his core charge.
Then Meghan Markle arrives in 2016.
The catalyst. Meeting her, falling in love, it forced everything to a head. Because suddenly, he saw history potentially repeating itself.
How so?
The way the media treated Meghan, he describes it as racist, misogynistic, it triggered all his deepest fears and protective instincts about his mother.
So protecting Meghan from that same fate became his absolute number one priority.
Above everything else, it seems. That's what the analysis suggests. It overrode loyalty, duty, everything.
And the relationship with William just completely deteriorated.
Leading to the breaking point, that physical fight in 2019. He claims William grabbed him, ripped his necklace, knocked him onto a dog bowl.
It's such a visceral image. The dog bowl. Was this just a one-off explosion?
Doesn't sound like it. The analysis suggests it was the climax of years of tension, building pressure, the institution kind of pitting them against each other, especially over Meghan. That necklace breaking.
Symbolize the bond breaking.
Yeah, the fraternal bond just shattering. He felt there was no going back after that.
He essentially concluded the institution had sort of consumed his brother, the heir apparent, and there was no safe space left for his own family.
Pretty much. So the decision to step back, Megxit, as the press called it, he frames it not as rejecting his family or the queen, necessarily.
It has self-preservation.
Pure self-preservation.
Yeah.
Choosing his immediate family's psychological well-being and safety over staying loyal to the institution and the role he was born into.
Okay, let's zoom out. It's an extraordinary story, very specific, but what are the universal takeaways here for you, the listener? Harry's journey from spare to someone trying to write his own script. It tells us a lot about facing adversity, doesn't it?
It really does. He went from avoidance, right? The partying, the numbing.
To a much more modern approach, therapy, actually naming the problem, and then physically removing himself from the environment he saw as toxic.
Which is a massive break from that traditional royal stiff upper lip.
So, what can we pull from this? Even if our lives are totally different, what are the core lessons?
Okay, first, I think there's a powerful emotional insight. Unprocessed grief is like a poison. It seeps into everything and shapes your choices until you face it head on. Harry's story really hammers home that you need to confront deep wounds, often with professional help, to actually heal.
Makes sense. What about intellectually?
The intellectual insight is about systems. The monarchy, as he portrays it, operates in a way that prioritizes keeping the institution itself going, protecting its image, sometimes over the truth or the well-being of the people inside it.
And that applies beyond royalty, right?
Oh, absolutely. Think about any large old organization, maybe even some family dynamics, where tradition and self-preservation resist change, even when it's hurting people.
Okay, emotional, intellectual. What's the big universal takeaway?
I think the universal insight is about identity. You have to build your identity. You can't just inherit it and expect to be fulfilled. For Harry, real purpose seemed to click only when he started creating things for himself, being a soldier, founding Invictus, becoming a father.
It points to that fundamental human need for self-determination, to choose your own path, regardless of where you started.
Exactly. And maybe his ultimate legacy, the human part of it, is trying to break that cycle of trauma and silence for his own kids, Archie and Lilibet, choosing authenticity and peace over the demands of his birthright.
It's undeniable that SPARE changed the global conversation, whatever you think of it. It really plugs into current discussions about mental health, about institutional problems, racism, media ethics in the digital age.
Yeah, it hit a nerve. His whole journey ultimately was about grabbing the pen, wasn't it? Taking control of his own story after decades of having it written for him.
Which leaves a pretty powerful question for you listening right now. What stories have been told about you, by your family, your job, the world? And maybe more importantly, what new story are you brave enough to start writing for yourself?
That's a great challenge to leave people with. Thanks for digging into SPARE with us today.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.